Welcome to the Untapped Philanthropy Podcast.
We're your hosts, Flux's co-founder Corinne Mitchell and Neon One's Tim Sarantonio. We've spent our career learning how to leverage technology and data in the social sector to better connect and serve our collective causes, constituents, and communities.
In this podcast series, we profile leaders, public figures, philanthropists, and industry experts to explore the fascinating intersection of funding, technology, and policy. We're here to analyze the most formative topics and trends that shape the present and future of philanthropy.
Hello, everyone. Today is an exciting episode focused on the grantee or the nonprofit perspective. That's one of the fun things about joining Untapped Philanthropy, and why I was excited to have Corinne ask me is I can bring in the nonprofit perspective.
And
we really wanted to start with a bang, if I'm going to be honest. And that's why we have Mallory Erickson.
This is the whole reason, Tim. Like, we were like talking about what Untapped Philanthropy needs, and the whole concept was like, how do we bring a larger voice to this? And I'm so excited today as well for the reason that I think it's expanding the conversation that had typically been happening on this podcast.
Yes. Well, Mallory, I'm going to let you kind of do your own introduction, but I'll read some nice words that we have for you, if that's okay. Mallory is a certified coach and nonprofit business leader who delivers unique programs around technical fundraising expertise and coaching skills necessary to address the fears and discomforts around asking for money. We're so happy to have her join us today. Hello, Mallory. How did we do?
Great. You can introduce me wherever I go. Thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. So excited for this conversation. And thank you for the really warm introduction.
Well, because I know both of you very well, I'm actually going to hand it over to Corinne. Corinne, why don't you kick us off for the conversation today?
Yeah. I mean, what even brought you to philanthropy? And then Tim's got his like go-to move that I'm not going to steal his thunder on. But like, how did you get into this? Give us a little background on who you are as a person. What brought you to philanthropy? Why is it that you've made an entire career of this and what you really see as your mission?
Yeah, wow. You know, it's actually quite rare that I get asked this question, but I do think it's so important what roots us to this work. So, you know, I actually grew up being involved in nonprofits and community service from a really young age. My family on my mother's side are all Holocaust survivors. And when they came to the US, it was nonprofits that helped them get on their feet, find places to work, find housing, had some pseudo foster care like support while the adults were trying to find work. And so the nonprofit ecosystem, and in Judaism, we call it tikkun olam, like repairing the world, is like built into my DNA. And so growing up, I was really involved in different types of community-oriented projects in my community, mostly through my youth group, actually. And it was just a big part of my identity. And a lot of what roots me to my work still today is my grandmother and growing up with her stories and growing up with the ways that these community organizations supported her to really rebuild a life in the aftermath of an incredibly traumatic experience. And so I feel really grateful for this sector. I think it makes me feel this deep hope and potential for what can be possible. And like everything that I love, it also means that I want to push it to be better and to recognize the gaps and the ways in which we are not living up to our potential with some of the systemic issues that are continually getting perpetuated. And so I have a deep desire to support this sector. And I think over the last few years, you know, I joke like an accidental fundraiser as I started to get promoted up through nonprofits, first in a managing director role, then an executive director role. And I really hated fundraising. And I got to a moment where I thought, okay, I think I need to leave the nonprofit sector because all of these leadership roles have a fundraising component and I cannot figure out how to make this fundraising thing work for me? And for me, the transformative moment was going through executive coach certification, getting trained in habit and behavior design. Those elements were not connected to my fundraising, but they dramatically impacted the way that I was fundraising. And not only did it have huge financial implications, but I started to feel fundamentally different as a fundraiser. And I started to actually really love fundraising. And so when I say, like, if I could love fundraising, anyone could love fundraising, I really mean it. And I think because of what I've realized is possible and the transformation that can happen with the right tools around fundraising, the more I want to support improving the lives of fundraisers by giving them unique tools and unique support that allow them to do their job in a more embodied and empowered way.
Well, obviously, a lot to unpack there, Mallory. just a bit. But we'll get there. I do at this time like to ask folks, and I know you know I love talking about this, but I've never actually gotten to ask you this question, which is, what is a moment of generosity that stands out to you that you've experienced either as a donor or as a fundraiser that just is kind of burned in a positive way in your head?
I mean, working with one of my biggest funders at the second to last organization I ran, and she just changed my life. I saw so many moments of generosity that changed my life in working with her. And one of the things that she did was really support my leadership development and my growth inside the organization. I was in a managing director role, and I was struggling to get board buy-in around things and ED buy-in around things. And she really believed in me, and she believed in the ways in which I was trying to grow the organization. And so this might seem like a funny example of generosity because we're always like unrestricted funding, not restricted funding. But basically she was like, she's like, I want to give a gift, you know, a substantial gift, and I want to do it in a way that's going to empower your leadership. So I'll give it to you unrestricted if you want, but is there a way you want this restricted that would empower you, that would give you the capacity to build something you've been trying to build, but have been struggling to get budget approval for? And it was just a really incredibly supportive moment in my career and transformed the organization for the better, ultimately, with what we got to do with that funding. And it's had a huge impact on me.
I actually love that really targeted way that takes some of the power back to you to say, hey, I need to also invest in myself and in the culture and what we're creating here. And I think if they had given it unrestricted, you probably would have felt compelled to say, hey, like, I should probably be giving some of this to other programs or other things that don't have funding. I like love that. So anyway, incredible.
And it was all operations. So it was 100% operational funding, which was amazing.
That's beautiful.
Well, and I'm in a situation right now where I'm giving some guidance to an organization that I really love. It's called Create Community Studios. And they're a small nonprofit, I think under $500,000 right now. There's only a handful of folks that work at the organization. And they're in a very practical reality that they kind of have to shift into a capital campaign just by necessity, for survival in some ways. So a lot of the conversations are going to be in the so-called restricted camp, because it's like, this is this need, this is this asset that we have. And they're telling it that story through there. What I'm trying to do is to also say, okay, where are those opportunities for that larger community of generosity to kick in? So I think that tracks and is definitely very interesting. Well, on that point then, Mallory, let's get into some of the things that drive those conversations, because this is your jam, right? So you've been researching very deeply the different behaviors that funders and fundraisers exhibit when they interact with each other. I'd love for you to expand on that from the nonprofit's perspective, but I'm going to give one little charge to you, because a lot of the folks listening might be on the foundation side, the traditional funder space, a foundation, a community organization, things like that. It would be interesting to hear that versus the differences of relationship building with an individual donor who might be passionate about the organization. What's different and what's the same?
Between like a foundation and an individual funder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
From the nonprofit's perspective.
Ooh, that's really interesting. Okay, there's so many layers to this to unpack. So I'll kind of start moving through it and just say short pieces at a time to make sure I don't speak for too long and you get sort of what you want from this.
Well, but we are interviewing you, so I think that's okay to a certain extent. Go for it.
Okay. Well, okay. So, I mean, when I'm thinking about the relationship that's happening between a fundraiser and a funder, first of all, just like at the high level in either, I'm really looking at like what creates connection. And when I say connection, I actually think about it in terms of like kind of biological, neurological, psychological connection. What are the things that allow us to feel open, to feel seen, to feel like we have space to let the other person be seen? What does it actually take to build a healthy relationship? And I would say a lot of times I try to think about this, not thinking about the fundraiser and funder relationship, but just healthy relationships in general. Because one of the things that worries me a little bit is that I hear people say all the time, fundraisers say all the time, oh, we have a strong relationship with that funder. And then when something happens and I ask them, okay, well, can we ask that funder about X, Y, and Z? They come back and they say, oh, no, we could never do that. And I said, well, okay, I thought you said that you have a strong relationship with them. And like, yeah, but we couldn't push back in that way or ask that kind of question. I'm like, okay, so what does strong relationship mean then? And I worry sometimes that strong relationship from a fundraising perspective just means we get money consistently. And I'd be curious for funders who see that sort of pattern, like what makes them consider a really strong relationship with a fundraiser? Is it just that they're getting the reports in a timely way and, you know, they're getting things on the deadlines that they set? Or do they have a relationship where they can really be in connection? And being in connection means creating enough safety, enough comfort to be able to talk about hard things, to be able to say, okay, we're in some uncharted territory here. How do we preserve all of the things that are wonderful about this partnership while we navigate these unclear waters? How do we make sure we're not jeopardizing our relationship at every speed bump in every way? And to recognize that there are these power dynamics. And so we have to think, you know, from a fundraiser's perspective, they're walking into a conversation with a funder. I mean, this is what I work to change inside of them, but they're walking into most relationships with a funder feeling a tremendous amount of scarcity. I hate to use this word, but probably a lot of desperation, a lot of self-worth tied to whether or not the funding is going to come through. They're letting those conversations and those funding decisions determine, you know, if they're on the right track, if they're worthy of funding. And so there's so much meaning around those meetings that I think puts then fundraisers into a real perfectionist and performative role, because those ways of being, perfectionism and performance, are protection methods. And so when we're in a level of such heightened vulnerability, we go into protection mode, totally understandably. And then when we're in that mode, when we're in perfectionism, we cannot actually connect. We cannot really connect because we're not letting ourselves be truly seen. And then we're not activating our empathy because we have a lot of tunnel vision around our own experience, our own fear, our own scarcity feelings. And so I worry about this dynamic with fundraisers because all they want is to deeply connect with their fundraisers, with their funders. But the fear that surrounds fundraising and the scarcity that surrounds fundraising and this cycle of annual funding and every year and will we ever have enough? And then the language around the sector, around there not being enough, puts their nervous system, in my mind, in an impossible situation to then walk into these moments and have their heart open for true connection. So before we talk about the funders, I'll just sort of stop there for a second and see what you guys think and if you have any questions about that.
You know, I think it's really interesting the way that we talk through the building of trust, because I think, you know, again, talking through the funders and kind of transitioning into that, that's all they want too, is to connect and create equality. Mm-hmm. But you're right, the dynamic of it, that concept of someone holds the money, someone needs the money, like it puts this imbalance in play. And I think there's a lot of things that people want to do for that. And we'll talk about that next, the idea of how to create a better experience for them and like what are some of your ideas around that. But I'm curious, like if you were to kind of list out, I don't know, one or two examples of maybe the biggest things that people see as the challenge. Are there certain things that are recurring?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know, you know, I don't know exactly what this would look like as I'm sort of thinking out loud, but I think anything a funder can do in a conversation, in a relationship, to kind of let down or release the pressure that not everything has to be perfect for there to be potential for partnership. I think that, and if there's any way for that stage to be set that, hey, you know, we're looking for alignment here. And whether there's alignment or not is something that has to be true on both sides. We want this to feel in alignment with you and your organization. And this needs to be in alignment with what we're trying to do over here at the foundation. And if there's deep alignment, and if we're trying to do and achieve the same thing together, then we want to have open conversations about that. And we want to hear about your real challenges. And we'd love to tell you, we can start, we can tell you what some of our challenges and some of our failures have been as a foundation trying to solve that issue. I've never seen a foundation do that. But what if they said, we'll go first. Let me tell you about something we tried that didn't work. And like really led that more open conversation, they let themselves, you know, it's interesting. You're really pushing me here because I always think about the connection piece being led by the fundraiser, right? And so I always say to fundraisers, like, you have to let yourself be known and then give space for the other person to be known. But particularly for foundations who are listening to this, like letting yourselves be known, really, truly be known, being vulnerable first, sharing about your failures or setbacks or hard lessons you've learned over the years, leading with that vulnerability, actually you can start building and creating space for that connection by letting yourself be more truly known instead of this kind of buttoned up institution that then pushes the nonprofit to also feel like they need to show up to the conversations with that same level of refinement and presentation.
You know, I've seen a couple places, you know, oftentimes foundations will ask like, hey, you know, nonprofit, what are places that you have best practices where you learn something, we want to share that with the community. But you're right, that inverse of where foundations have made missteps or taken a wrong turn here or there, that's not as common. And I love that kind of transparency that's a part of it. There's actually this a venture capitalist named Bessemer who has on their website the funniest freaking thing. It says all the things that they said no to, and it was like some of the craziest, most prolific companies that exist today. But it was this really interesting self-reflection that I remember in kind of running into them, I was like, that's just this profound, almost disarming way to be able to open conversation and be like, that's freaking hilarious that happened, or whatever it be. But it puts people on that same level of humanity so that you can have that trust conversation. You can feel like you're not hoisting yourself into a power dynamic that might be, like you said, disadvantageous for many reasons, let alone mentally and psychologically. So mm-hmm. I think that's a very interesting concept to make things real human very quickly.
Yeah. And you know what's so hard about the word trust, I feel like, in our sector, I'd be curious what you think about this, is I feel like because of so much stigma that has surrounded nonprofits for so many years, when we hear the word trust, there's almost this like stigma around, you know, how funds are going to be used, right? Can we trust how the funds are going to be used? And trust around, you know, transparency of things like that, or the overhead myth, right? All those different things. As opposed to trust in, like, are you going to be a good partner? Are you going to be honest with me about things that happen in our relationship? Can I trust that this can be a healthy relationship and a true partnership. And so I think when nonprofits hear, you know, they have to build funder trust, again, that's this thing that moves them into perfectionism and kind of performance mode, because what they think that trust building looks like is a perfectly crafted impact report. And what I hear you saying is what the funder is also looking for in that trust is real conversation. And those things are just like missing each other. And so I feel like this word, we use this word as if we mean and feel the same thing. But I think the way in which the word gets internalized is so different.
Well, and I think what also is making this difficult on both sides is a lot of the stories that get told of success are very polished. And they can drive the narrative. I watched one of the newest Charity Water videos, for instance, and the first 5 seconds are they say, if you donate to us, you might feel that it's going to this. And it flashes a bunch of mansions and things that imply financial mismanagement. And they say 100% of your donation goes to this. And it shows the mission and all this type of stuff. And they have a very unique model. And so I don't want to pick on them. I think it's one of the most innovative individual giving programs in the world, but we can't use that as our example, because if we try to be like Charity Water or these very large, flashy programs that look very polished and set, that that discounts the messy reality right. of often misalignment that we have to work through.
Right. Absolutely. Well, let's talk about what that could be. I mean, where are places that we could move into? You know, break down some of those barriers, provide more friendly experiences. Like, what are some of the perspectives of the nonprofit on some of those places where we can really increase and push that through? And that's something we've actually talked about before. Our last podcast guest, Chantal Forrester, was talking a ton about the need to move through that. And I think the willingness and interest is there from the you know, kind of grantors or grant makers. But I actually think they're not exactly sure what to do. Short of trying to make things better, improve system look and feel. There are some activities, for example, like, you know, common applications, the philanthropic data commons. There's probably about 17,000 mm-hmm. of those at this point. You know, there's a lot of movement through that. But where do you see some of the big wins, the call to action from the fundraiser side that you would say, or that you would say this would be advantageous for us as a group to be able to work in a realm that has X, Y, and Z present?
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, I'm going to give a bunch of ideas, and some of them might be realistic and some of them might not be, but I'm going to do both.
I love it. Get in there.
Dream dream big, Mallory. Let's do it.
Yes. You know
okay,
what?
Okay.
Everything's possible in this world.
Yeah.
It's a safe space here, at least.
Okay. So, I mean, well, one thing I'll say, and I don't have all these notes in front of me. I wish I did, but I did a two-part series with an expert in neurodivergent leadership and an ADHD expert. And we actually segmented her podcast episode, because the second one, we really focused on funders and what they can do to make their processes more accessible. And one of the things that might be really enlightening for folks to check out, one of the things, I have ADHD myself, one of the things I can just speak for ADHD in particular, that's really challenging from a fundraising relationship, are sequences are very hard with ADHD. And so grant management systems that have a really extensive sequence with a ton of different deadlines and if-then statements with no prompts within the system itself are very challenging for folks with ADHD or other neurodivergent folks. So I think there are systems and processes alone that, from an accessibility perspective, there's a lot that could happen in that space. And, you know, one of the things that she talked about on the episode that was really enlightening to me is that there has been some research done around the relationship between folks who are justice oriented and folks who have ADHD that a higher, there's like, it's called justice sensitivity. And so it would indicate that actually we have a higher level of neurodivergence and particularly ADD and ADHD inside our sector. And so that sort of accessibility in that process is really something that we should be thinking about. I also, you know, I interviewed recently, it hasn't come out yet, but a scientist who studies the nervous system, she's a nervous system expert. And she talked about how the three of the things that lead to burnout, particularly for highly sensitive people, which also we have a higher percentage of inside the nonprofit sector, is inequity, lack of resources, and lack of autonomy. That those three prongs lead to burnout. And when I heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, I want to send this to every funder because I think that also has huge implications for what we think about from the unrestricted funding piece, from how we handle the amount of funding that we give towards certain initiatives. But I think like thinking about like, are we really setting folks up with the resources they need to actually do the work that we're trying to do? And then the autonomy piece, oh yeah, is all about, you know, unrestricting those funds. And then the inequity piece, which is something, you know, I'm sure you're talking about on here a lot, how we can make these processes more equitable, which also has that accessibility element. So those are some like overarching frameworks that I would think about. And then on that interpersonal level, I think really, you know, funders, one, I would love it if funders wrote back to everyone who wrote them and applied, even if they had a standard template email that just didn't ghost fundraisers, because ghosting is like one of the hardest things for us to downregulate from. And it is such an activating activity when we feel like we're losing our sense of belonging and identity. Like that question of like, did they get this? Do they see me? Do I matter? And I know that foundations can't fund everyone and they don't have time to meet with everyone. But if they could just acknowledge everyone, I actually think it would go really far.
I love that. And actually, as someone that also is neurodivergent in that same way you are, I do feel like there are small behaviors and things that can definitely bring us forward and protect the safety of folks involved. And it's funny because I don't know that, like, as someone who, again, I'm from technology. So I grew up, you know, basically running a company at the time in a male-dominated, you know, environment when VCs weren't necessarily as focused on female funding and other aspects. And it was interesting because little things like that, like you said, the validations, they keep you going when they don't realize that there are small battles that each person might also be fighting that keep them from being able to move forward on things and having small confirmations or structures that build appreciation are huge. And I look at that as someone that actually is now on a couple boards for nonprofits. And I'm now trying to help, you know, they're like, oh, well, Corinne, you work in fundraising, you can go fundraise for us. And I was like, well, actually, I'm just in technology. but it is unbelievably challenging when you're a small nonprofit to be able to come in and have that fortitude built in. So I think it's something that I guess we don't think enough about sometimes. And I realize those are smaller nonprofits. And maybe my example here is not as common, but I do think it's more common than not around some of the folks that I think are running into this concept of, you know, hey, if we can get funding here, but I haven't heard back from them. And then it's just a ghosting situation. And they, you know, they build structures and expectations around it. But I do wonder, you know, what are some of the things that funders could do? You know, other than just, you know, replying back to emails. Yes, absolutely, please. But providing that psychological safety for the nonprofits, you know, how can we start to look at that? What are other mechanisms that would be good to employ?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is, you know, transparency around process and timeline, right? And I think anything that you can do to provide nonprofits with transparency and clarity around, you know, what percentage of folks get through the next round. Okay, this is our process, you know, because I feel like that's the other thing. Folks go into these grant processes and it's so different from funder to funder, foundation to foundation. They don't know, are they going to have three meetings, one meeting? You know, when will they hear back in a month, in 4 months, at the end of the the year. And so I think if funders from the beginning can say, hey, here's a little bit of our process, you know, we're having this first like meet and greet, get to know you session. After this, you know, we'll follow up and invite you to submit, you know, if an LOI, if that feels like a fit, if that, you know, and I see foundations do this sometimes, but anything that can sort of like set up some expectations for folks from the beginning. And then to say, you know, we just want you to know, like, we're excited to have this first meeting and getting to know you. And we want you to know that 10% of organizations actually get to the next round. So that helps them also feel like it's not just them. They're not the only one. They can actually set expectations a little bit more realistically and make some decisions about their own time. You know, if folks are going on a website and there's a huge grant application, which by the way, please make your grant applications more simple, but they go on, there's a huge grant application for $2,500 or $5,000. They're already trying to decide, is this worth, you know, $5,000? But if they knew 92% of folks that apply do not get this grant, that would really help them make some decisions about their time management. And so I would just say, like, all the invisible space around grant funding and foundation funding just leaves a lot to the imagination. And it leads to a lot of uncertainty and lack of clarity and lack of decision-making in other areas. Sometimes I'll talk to an organization who, I remember I talked to an organization once and they were like, well, we have like $12 million in grants submitted. And then I was not involved in their foundation or their grant process, but I remember talking to them at the end of the year and they were like, oh yeah, we had a 92% close rate on that. And I remember, you know, at the beginning, like, they were feeling so confident about having submitted $12 million in grants, right? And so I just, like, if there's anything we can do to really provide some of those percentages to give that clarity, that would be really helpful. And then I think on an interpersonal level, like I was saying before, the more that foundation leaders and grant managers can be human and can acknowledge their own challenges, or even to acknowledge the challenges of the system, like, we know this is a lot and we understand if this is too many steps in a process to go through. You know, we really want to be respectful of your time. We won't progress you to the next round unless we really do feel like it's a fit, but this is what happens. And so, you know, we want to make sure, like, how can we support you through this process? We're really grateful for the time that you spend, you know, going through this with us. We learned so much. I mean, something that just kind of starts to shift those power dynamics and really asks the nonprofits what they need in this process too. I think those are things that can really help open up more of that trust.
The part I find compelling is, you know, I have, for example, I'm on a contemporary dance, you know, board, and she's a dancer. She's incredible. She's this wonderful creator and creative spirit that does not know, you know, how to run financial structures from, you know, upside versus forecast versus baseline, you know, assumptions. So it's not only being able to help her understand what's reasonable, but actually help her, you know, as a board member, I want to be able to come in and jump in and work with her financials and say, okay, let's look at the different grants you have. And based on the, you know, the confidence level, adjust to our operating plan accordingly. And what's interesting is her optimism is wonderful, everything is in her like standard forecast. So I was like, I think this is all upside. So it's very interesting because it changes fundamentally how we operate the organization for the rest of the year. And it's putting some of those practices in that I'm welcome, you know, more than excited to be able to do. But I think to your point, like, there's no concept of what reality is, and it makes it very challenging to operate financials for any organization, let alone a nonprofit.
Well, Corinne, you can come help my organization that I'm doing capital campaign work for that.
My finance background, it's like such a faux finance background from when I was like, I'm like, I used to be in finance. It was when I was like 25. So it's been like 20 years. Let's just put a cap on that and call it a day.
Well, I think this does touch on an important thing before we shift into our kind of wrap up of our formal discussion with you, Mallory, and then we shift to a fun rapid fire questions format, by the way. So that's kind of the flow. So one of the things that I wanted to make sure we touched on is there's a lot of indications that this is going to be definitely a weird year economically. And especially in the nonprofit space, some of the preliminary things that we're seeing in the Fundraising Effectiveness Project show that this is going to be a potentially frustrating fundraising environment across the board. And so these little behaviors, these small shifts and changes, I know you really live in that well, Mallory. Can you talk about how this type of change that we're talking about adds up into big impact if embraced?
Yeah. I mean, to me, look, the reality is that as fundraisers, I mean, one of the things that I think gets confused is that fundraising is this series of tasks. And I really think that fundraising is about the being, how you can you be a fundraiser and continue to wake up every day and put yourself out there and send that email and walk into that meeting and face rejection and get ghosted and get back up the next day and do it all over again. Like the being a fundraiser is incredibly hard. And when we think about what leads to resilient fundraisers, and fundraisers are what determine the fundraising, right? So I always talk about the fact that donor behavior, funder behavior is a response behavior. It's a response to what the fundraiser does. So by focusing on the fundraiser, how they show up, how they're embodied, how resilient they are, and I don't mean resilient like, you know, push through, but resilient, like have the conditions for resilience around them. Those things are going to impact every day their ability to prompt that next donor, to click send on the email. Those seem like very simple tasks, but they are not easy tasks. They are simple tasks, but not easy tasks. They are hard tasks because they are scary tasks. And so all these tiny little things that we're talking about, funders not ghosting fundraisers, having a moment of expressing our own challenges and down-regulating the nervous systems of everybody in the room, those are healing practices. Those are what create the conditions for resilience for those fundraisers. That's what allows them to feel connected. And when we feel connected, that's when we're getting energy. In connection, we are not burning out. And I think it's because we are so disconnected in our perfectionist performance bubbles, just trying to get the next amount of funding through to make payroll, that we lose the things that are actually healing and supportive to do the fundraising. So we might check those boxes on the list, but we're not really showing up in a way that allows us to move money, because moving money, in my opinion, is what requires connection. And so every little way that we make ourselves more open to each other and leave space for fundraisers to be more open, to be more themselves, to be more connected, is what allows them to raise more money, not just with us, but with everyone.
The only issue with a mic drop, it might sound weird on the podcast, but I think we're just going to put a little bow on that. And that was fantastic, Mallory. That was just really, really inspiring too. And I expect nothing less. So
you set the bar pretty high.
What? Well, there you go. That is true. But you know, exceeded. So it's actually funny that you talked about energy. So we're going to shift to some rapid fire questions. This is kind of like, I wouldn't say, Corinne, this is our stupid pet tricks or whatever that Letterman had, but like it is a fun.
I love our stupid pet tricks. It's the best. It's like exciting.
It is. So we have rapid fire questions. There's a few things we always ask, and there's a few things that are specific to you. And so the very first one, and we wrote this down beforehand, though we have been known to do rapid fire updates in the brief while the episode is going, by the way, folks.
<That's true. laughs>
What? See, you have a vulnerability. We're showing behind the curtain.
I have not read any of these questions.
There you go. We just dropped it right into it. So actually, right? Mallory, for you, first rapid fire question. What gives you the motivational energy to tackle big things?
I think the belief that everything can be different.
Hell yeah. I like that one. All right.
I thought you were going to talk about your kid, but okay.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm not winning Mom of the Year today, but I mean, I want everything to be different for her. You know, I want everything to be different for everyone.
I love it.
I want to see people healed and whole and for money to move more freely. And I believe it's possible. I just think we've been focused on unlocking the wrong things.
It should be noted, then we'll move on to Corinne's next question. Mallory has her own podcast, What the Fundraising. It's fantastic. And her daughter has been a guest.
My three-year-old.
Get out.
It's very cute.
Yeah.
So eloquent, I'm sure. That's amazing.
Go. Corinne, your question.
All right. This is one of my interview questions, which you guys can steal. It's one of my favorite interview questions. But I often ask people, you know, if you could do a TED Talk on any topic, what would it be? But because I now know that your daughter is also a prolific, amazing speaker as well. So I'll give you one professional and one personal so that you can actually honor, you know, both sides of your person. TED Talk on any topic.
Oh my gosh. If I could give a TED Talk on any topic, it would be fundraiser wellness and that how unlocking fundraisers is the key to unlocking funding. That's it. And gosh, I don't know if I have a TED Talk that could span beyond my professional lens at this point. I'll have to think about that one.
Okay. You can come back to us on that one. No big deal.
Your TED Talk would be how to spin up a fundraiser coloring book in less than
a week. Yes. Okay. It could be that too.
Mallory had this amazing project where she actually has created a fundraising coloring book. So any listener, the very first person to email me, tim@neonone.com, about that, I will get you a copy of that book.
Fancy.
You gotta be the very first person. Now we're gonna see
things on our podcast.
Corinne, this is concrete attribution data that we might be able to receive from this episode.
Okay. So I'm liking there we that.
Go. All right. Okay, keep it going. Another question.
Publication or book that most inspired you?
Ooh, I love The Way of Integrity by Martha Beck.
Ooh.
I don't have one. This podcast is going to put me in debtor's prison because I'm going to have to buy like every book and every resource that people talk about.
And you actually will, and then you'll read it and be like, didn't you read it, Corinne? And I'll be like,
no, it's on my
yet.
Bedside table next to the 15 other books I told you I would read.
Yes.
I have very similar conversations.
It's awful in this house. So my wife is not pleased. So besides maybe using it to disappear some of the books, or at least organize them, if you had a magic wand to change something in the sector, so not your house to fit more books, but the sector, what would it be?
I would wipe out scarcity mindset from our brains.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Wonder what would be possible.
Well, you can do.
Yeah. But I had a magic wand, so I went big.
Yeah. Can go anywhere. Absolutely. I like that you're thinking big on all these things. So indeed, appreciate all the insights you brought us today. And Mallory, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast and sharing more about yourself, your work, all the incredible things that you're up to. Our listeners can learn more about Mallory and the Power Partners Formula at MalloryErickson.com. That's MALLORY, Erickson, ERICKSON. Thank you, Mallory, so much. What a joy.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for the conversations that you're having here. I really appreciate what you all are doing.
You can listen and download our episodes at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and of course, directly from our website at flux.io. That's FLUXX.io.